morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Forrester. Counsel for the defense.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Captain Gene Hamm with Lieutenant Colonel Hendricks. I represent the appellant. Now, basically what we have in this case is the government sought counsel's crib sheet. The affidavit, Sergeant Porter's affidavit, provides all the facts and legal conclusions that are necessary to convict my client for forgery and larceny. The case that Sergeant Porter, the victim, alleged victim in this case, is the owner of the account, bank account, specifies the amount of money that's involved, and also identifies the checks that are allegedly forged. Also, he clearly states that this is not his, these are not his signatures on the checks, and he did not consent to authorize anyone to write these checks, and that he did not benefit from these checks. To borrow the Supreme Court's words in Davis, this is an obvious substitute for live testimony, because it does precisely what a witness does in a direct examination. Now, furthermore, not only is a prosecutorial use of this, not only does this document provide all the facts and conclusions necessary to convict my client, but also the prosecutorial use of this document is an inevitable conclusion. Just looking at the document, Your Honor, Sergeant Porter, the alleged victim in this case, agrees to not only have the document delivered to law enforcement and prosecutor, but also he agrees to cooperate with law enforcement authority for prosecution of any criminal prosecution, but also states that he understands that affidavit will be available at a later trial and will be relied on by a prosecutor. Now, without the alleged victim's affidavit, as the military judge found, there is no other evidence that shows that the victim, the alleged victim in this case, that a Sergeant Porter did not consent to the...
Let's go to the threshold question. Was he available?
Your Honor,
remember, we're in a war, and there evidently were substantial exigencies of military operations involving this guy. So, was he available?
Your Honor, he was available, or at least the government failed to show that he was not unavailable, Your Honor. It is, as this court has stated, basically the test is whether the government made a good faith effort, that is, whether the government exhausted every reasonable means to secure the witness's live testimony. However, that was not the case in this case, Your Honor. Not only did the government fail to exhaust every reasonable means of...
How so?
Well, Your Honor, looking at the record, it is rather unclear how much of a reasonable effort the government had made. I mean, it seems that...
Be more specific if you can. Say, based on record page, umpty frats, be very specific. What in the record indicates what they did and whether they made a valid effort as far as you're concerned?
Your Honor, unfortunately, the record is rather sparse on that point. Basically, what we know is the commander was unwilling to make Sergeant Porter available for the trial.
Wasn't that an ipsy-dixit?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that an ipsy-dixit? The command was unwilling to make him available, therefore, that wasn't good enough.
Your Honor, the court has to distinguish between unavailability because of military necessity and unwillingness. The words of the trial counsel was, basically all we know is that the trial counsel made a couple of phone calls to the battery commander, and the battery commander, who talked to the battalion commander, said, look, they are not willing to make him available for trial. It's not...
this is based on the record 18 and 19. Is that where you're at?
Yes, Your Honor. On record 19, Your Honor. That's what the trial counsel states. He says the words that he used were not that the government is unable to produce him because of specific needs of whatever Sergeant Porter mission at the unit were, but that the government, the battery commander, the battalion commander, were unwilling to make him available and would not make him available for trial.
Counsel, let's focus on burdens here. At the trial, who had the burden of demonstrating either availability or unavailability?
The government's burden, Your Honor.
Government's burden. What's your source for that?
This court has stated that in United States versus Ortiz, Your Honor, and also the Supreme Court in Ohio v. Roberts stated that the government has to make a good faith effort, Your Honor.
Okay, so the government bears the burden of demonstrating unavailability.
Yes, Your Honor.
And what would we look to determine whether the material on 18 or 19 about the unwillingness of the battery to make him available establishes a sufficient record.
Well, Your Honor, in order for the government to show that established that the witness was unavailable, we would have liked to have seen number one, some inquiry about number one, what type of steps did the government, the child counsel, make to find out what it takes to bring Sergeant Porter back from Iraq, and also what types of difficulty would he have faced, and how long would it have taken, what type of flights would he need to take. As we all know, Your Honor, these days, when soldiers coming back from Iraq, whether it's on trial or R&R, it's a common event, Your Honor. I mean, somebody coming back from Iraq would not be such a big issue. However,
can we take judicial notice of the fact that numerous cases involving events in Iraq are taking place in the United States, and that witnesses for those trials are traveling back and forth from Iraq? Or is that a matter that is not before this court?
That would not be a matter that's before the court. However, I'm just referencing that. So,
not asking to testify.
Yes, Your Honor. Again, another thing the trial court, the military judge could have done was to determine there could be further inquiry between the trial, military judge and the trial counsel. As the military judge could have asked, okay, what steps have you taken? But all we know from the record, Your Honor, is that the trial counsel made a couple of phone calls to the battery commander. He did not even bother talking to the battalion commander himself, or go even higher than that.
Does the record establish where the battalion was at this time?
The defense counsel conceded that the sergeant, not sure about the battalion, but I'm presuming that is the case, Your Honor, was in Iraq.
And what were they doing in Iraq? Does the record establish what they were doing?
Your Honor, we just don't know, Your Honor. All we know is that they deployed. And that is, and the defense was not disputing that fact, Your Honor. However, the defense, this point is, and the appellate position is, the government bears the burden to exhaust every reasonable means to secure the witness. However, that just wasn't done in this case, Your Honor.
Well, counsel, even if the government did not show that he was unavailable, why is it that this affidavit is a testimonial statement within the meaning of Crawford?
Well, Your Honor, again, the first issue the court needs to determine is, number one, determine whether it's testimonial or document or not.
And that's what I'm asking. Why is this a testimonial document?
Well, this court, after the Supreme Court case of Davis, this court had an argument just a few months ago, provided us with three factors to determine and to consider and determine whether what the primary purpose of the document is.
Okay, and isn't the primary purpose of the document in this case, from the perspective of the person that gave it, to get his money back?
And it may be true that Sergeant Porter was interested in receiving the money back. However, that is receiving, being reimbursed from the bank for the alleged loss that he was incurred. However, this has to be in determining the primary purpose of the document.
Is it your argument that the primary purpose of the document is law enforcement solely because there's one line in it that says that it may be used for that purpose? Is that your argument?
And on the face of the document, it is, and it clearly states what the purpose of the document is, Your Honor, yes. And
No. Let's be clear. It says that one permissible use of the document. That doesn't make it the primary purpose, does it?
On the face of the document, Your Honor, I believe an objective witness would definitely be able to read that primary purpose of this document was to gather evidence for a potential prosecution, Your Honor. And the test for the Supreme Court gave us whether the primary purpose was to establish or prove past events that are potentially relevant to later criminal prosecution. And on the face of the document, that is rather, and it's pretty plainly stated, right above where Sergeant Porter signed five times, Your Honor.
And why did they have him sign five times, counsel? So that were they going to use that in a criminal prosecution, or was that to protect themselves from his fraud against them, from him coming in and saying someone else forged these checks when, in fact, he signed the checks?
It may very well be both, this document nonetheless created with a view towards litigation or trial or potential criminal prosecution, whether it is of Sergeant Forster or Sergeant Porter himself. Now,
well, you keep on saying that it was created for the purpose of trial, and I guess I question that assertion when one purpose is that the guy can't get his money back from the bank until he satisfies his requirement, and when the bank, at least theoretically I would assume, needs to protect itself against multiple people coming in and trying to get money for them, for the check that was that they actually negotiated, and for someone coming in and saying, this wasn't my signature, give me my money back. So why aren't those the primary purposes?
Well, Your Honor, as this court has stated in banking, and considering the primary purpose, what we're looking at, again, is contextual analysis, and but what we're looking at is not only the purpose of the person that is making it, but we also have to look at the purpose for which was enlisted, that is the purpose of the recipient in this case, that is the bank. And looking at, even though, I guess one way to look at it would be this way, Your Honor, there is nothing that requires the bank to have an affidavit in order to reimburse somebody. They could simply receive a phone call from the customer and said, okay, well, all you have to do is shoot an orange flare up in the air, not about this evening, and we'll reimburse you. Now, this is, and about how...
Would you reimburse someone based on a phone call? I want to go to your bank.
my point, I mean, what I would like to say is not that there were... This is not simply just an arbitrary requirement by the bank. This was made by the bank, and one can only assume that bank probably ran into this type of situation before. But what they needed to do was collect an evidence so that they can go after and be reimbursed and prosecute somebody that committed these crimes and be reimbursed.
Counsel, let's focus right on that. What in the record, if anything, would establish that this document was created at the behest of prosecutorial authorities, encouragement of prosecutorial authorities, or any involvement of prosecutorial authorities?
In this case, this affidavit was, there's nothing in the record that shows that.
So if there's nothing in the record that shows that the government was an actor in the collection of this information, how does it fall to be a Crawford problem?
Well, Your Honor, the Supreme Court of Davis left that question open and did not answer that question. So we believe, first of all, that factor is not a determining factor in this case. However,
it is a factor, though, isn't it?
Your Honor, yes, it is. However, what is clear from the face of the document, Your Honor, is that this is a functional equivalent of such a sworn statement to CID. Not only did Mrs. Avens, for instance, the bank employee, testify that this is the first document, this is the first step in their investigation.
Well, counsel, just to be clear, it sounds to me that what you're asking us to do is to assume that whenever any use may be made of a document, or whenever any statement is included in a document suggesting that it may be used by law enforcement, that it therefore becomes testimonial for purposes of Crawford. Is that what you're asking us to do?
Essentially, yes. I mean, the reason I say that is, Your Honor, because, again, the test that Davis provided to us is that the primary purpose, whether the primary purpose was to establish for potentially, well, a document that is potentially relevant to a criminal prosecution. And, again, that is a contextual analysis. And whether it was made to law enforcement or not is only one of the three factors that this court had stated in Rankin. The second factor is whether, you've got to look at the level of formality that's involved in this, and you can see that this is more than just a routine and objective cataloging of ambiguous facts. And also,
this is the document, is it not, on which the bank makes the decision as to whether to reimburse, correct?
Yes, it is.
So you would agree or concede that there at least is a banking purpose to the document?
That I believe is what the...
So when you're debating the primary purpose, law enforcement or banking, Is that a fair way to look at it, that, that your seesaw has banking on one side and law enforcement on the other?
Well, I believe it better, if I understand your question properly, I mean, correctly, Your Honor, I believe even though the bank states, the bank employee, Mrs. Abel, stated that, we require this document from the customer before we reimburse them, that may not be the primary purpose for which they collect them.
No, and all I'm trying to get you to say is, without tricking you, is there is a banking purpose to this document, is there not?
Oh, if you want, okay. I do not doubt
I just want to get a sense of what, when we're debating primary purpose, that as between what? If there's only one purpose to the document, then it's pretty clear what the primary purpose is.
Your Honor, again, the primary purpose has to be, it's a contextual analysis from an object, it's an objective standard, Your Honor, not necessarily the primary purpose of the person that's making it or the bank. However, what a...
whose purpose? Not the maker, not the bank, what some independent, reasonable person out there.
Exactly, Your Honor. I mean, this, the purpose of the person that's making it and the person that's receiving it is only one of the factors that we need to reconsider in determining what an objective person that's removed from this incident would see the document as. And again, Davis had no...
Is that from Davis? Is that this reasonable observer, is that a Davis? In the Davis holding?
And this court in Rankin.
And in Rankin.
And what about your comment on the formal nature of the document? I mean, that's from Justice Thomas's dissent in Davis, right? It's not the holding of the court.
Your Honor, in Davis, I believe that's it is one of the factors that the court, Supreme Court, considered in determining whether a statement of Amy Hammond and also the statement in Davis was a testimonial document or not.
But it's only Justice Thomas in the dissent in Davis that says that you need to have a formal document for it to be testimonial.
Your Honor, I do not recall specifically exactly that point, but however, one point in Davis stated that formality of a creation of document is one of the key factors. And I believe that was in the majority opinion, Your Honor. And looking at the formality of the document, it is clear this is rather a formal document. Number one, Sergeant Porter was not only required to...
Well, business records tend to be formal, too, don't they?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Regular old business records tend to be formal as well.
Not necessarily, Your Honor.
Not necessarily, but...
It could be, Your Honor, but not necessarily.
I have a question. Were you done with your question? There are at least three issues dancing around this case. One is unavailability or availability. One is testimonial or not. And one is, if not testimonial, business record or residual. Which of those three issues is your strongest one and why?
Your Honor, I would say it's all of them. And really, for this, it's actually the same reason, because again...
So if I find that one of the three is really weak, you're prepared for me to view them all as equally weak. You say they're of equal value to you, so you're going to rise or fall on your statement that if one's weak, they're all weak. You don't care to say that one is particularly strong and why? It's your prerogative.
Your Honor, I'd say the testimonial document, the testimonial nature of this document, would be the strongest argument, because again, if you look at the three factors from this court provided from Rankin, and also consider the level of formality and also the purpose for which this was made, this is on its face, Your Honor, it is a testimonial document. Unlike normal business record, data entry that this court had considered made earlier. Unlike that, the maker of this document, I don't know, would have been able to read it on the face. face of the document that this is made for testimony, I mean, for prosecutorial purpose. And also, for the exactly same reason and exactly for the same fact, this would not be a business record, Your Honor. And two other federal courts at least recognize that fact, and U.S. v. Sandals in the Sixth Circuit, and also Hicks v. United States in the Washington District Court, Your Honor. And as for unavailable, Your Honor, again, the government had to make a reasonable, at least exhaust every reasonable means to produce the witness. However, that simply was not done. And the record is rather sparse, unfortunately, and as for what types of effort the government had made, it really seems like there really wasn't a whole lot of effort to begin with, Your Honor. And also, on top of that, not only was the Sergeant Ford not unavailable, however, Sergeant Forster never had an opportunity to cross-examine, and this court had made it clear that the opportunity to cross-examine means physical face-to-face confrontation. However, that simply wasn't done, and there's no exception or policy exception in this case, since we don't have a child victim, and there was insufficient facts as to whether there's a really military necessity in this case.
But if it's not part of the investigation, and if we disagree with you and think that it is indeed a business record, would it be the case that if you're right, any business record that's ever used in court as or could be expected to be used in court as part of a prosecution is testimonial for purposes of Crawford and Davis? Whether it had anything to do with the police investigation or was at the government's behest or not.
I just want to make sure I understand your question properly. Are you asking me whether any types of business record would be considered a document that was created with eye towards trial? I mean, if that's your question, Your Honor, that would not be the case. You know, certainly there are certain business records. Your Honor, the Supreme Court...
My question is slightly different, I think, which is my question is, isn't it the case that if we accept your argument that whenever there's a business record that, you know, that part of the reason it's created, that when it's created, it could be anticipated that it might be used as part of a criminal prosecution, that it therefore falls within Crawford and Davis, even if there was never any government involvement in its creation, and even if it wasn't created at the behest of the government, but rather for the purposes of the business?
That would not be the case, Your Honor.
Well, if that would not be the case, why is this any different?
The underlying reason for, as you know, Your Honor, underlying reason for the business record exception is that it's the routine that the business carries on the day-to-day activity that makes it reliable. However, in a case like this, when a victim is coming in, an alleged victim is coming in and alleging to be the victim of a crime and tells and creates or signs a document before a notary saying, okay, I need to have this document delivered to prosecutor, and also I agreed to cooperate with law enforcement agencies and understand that they will rely on this document. Clearly, this is a document that was created for litigation purposes. And the Supreme Court made that clear. It's well said in law, Your Honor, that a document that was created with a view towards trial in litigation court, for instance, would not be a business record. And for the same reason, this would not qualify as a testimonial document. This would be a testimonial document. For the same reason that this was created with a view towards trial. And this was definitely not made in the regular course of business. And one of the things that makes a business record a business record is that the maker of the document, the source of the document, has some sort of a business duty to create such a document. However, Sergeant Porter, in this case, definitely did not have such a duty.
Well, now, wait a minute. It brings back to Judge Baker's question. The bank needs a record to justify reimbursing the guy. The guy needs a record to get the reimbursement. If that isn't the normal course of banking business, what is?
Your Honor, this would be akin to the employee statement of Homer V. Hoffman that was created by an employee after a train accident. This would be a business document that are not created for litigation purpose would not have those types of language on the face of the document saying that I agree to cooperate with law enforcement agency and I agree that they will...
If you sign your tax return under penalty of perjury, as you do, and you're aware of the fact that criminal tax prosecution is a potential, is the tax return created with an eye toward prosecution?
No, Your Honor, that would not be the case. However, again, just plain language of the document, Your Honor, on the face of it, it states what the primary purpose is. But in tax return, for instance, we do not have that language on the tax return, Your Honor, at least as far as I can remember, Your Honor, from reading the document. And for that reason, that this is a creative way of the face of the document, Your Honor, I mean, it's pretty clear that Sergeant Porter would have had understood, even though his purpose may have been to receive money back from the bank or be reimbursed from the bank, a reasonable person that's reading the document, also Sergeant Porter reading the document, would have understood, and that's what it states, Your Honor, that this would have been used for prosecutorial purpose. And this would have been created in anticipation of the litigation, Your Honor. And again, for that same reason, this is not a business record, and also this would be a testimonial document. This is precisely what a witness would do in a courtroom that is show up and testify under oath that he is Jason W. Porter, residing at Esquire, and these are the statements. And looking at the government's closing argument, Your Honor, and what it's all done, and it's clear that this is the primary document that the government had relied on and was therefore not harmless beyond reasonable doubt.
Does that answer your question, Judge Sturby?
Thank you. You have an opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government.
May it please the Court. I am Captain Magdalena Acevedo, and along with Colonel John Miller, I represent the government in this case. Sergeant Porter's affidavit was non-testimonial because the primary purpose of the evidence was not the creation of evidence for a later prosecution. Similarly, there was no government involvement in its creation. As such, the military judge properly admitted the affidavit, and this court should affirm the findings and sentence. Four factors show that the primary purpose of this document was not the creation of evidence for a later prosecution. First, looking at the face of the affidavit has several possible uses, the first of which is not litigation. In fact, the majority of the uses are for FDIC purposes, insurance, holding due course, bank business. Second, the military judge in the present case specifically found that, quote, "This is not a document created for any law enforcement purpose. Document prepared so that Sergeant Porter could be reimbursed for checks." And that's why this document's created, so Sergeant Porter could get his money back. Third factor for this court to consider is that at the time that this...
Counsel, was he available?
No, he was not, Your Honor. The military judge again made findings of fact regarding availability. And the record shows that, one, defense counsel admitted that Sergeant Porter was deployed in Iraq. It also shows the trial counsel spoke to several levels of command, and primarily because of Sergeant Porter's position as a squad leader, he could not come to the court-martial.
Well, hang on. There's an issue of substance and an issue of process, and clearly it's hard to argue that being deployed in a combat zone or perhaps on your way to a combat zone is not a pretty compelling reason to be unavailable. But one issue this case raises is whether it's good enough for the government to call some random person whose name they can't remember to say, well, I talked to someone and they said he's not available, thanks, go away. Is that a model method by which to determine availability?
No, it's not, Your Honor. Certainly the trial counsel could have done more here. However, ultimately, unavailability isn't really at issue because the business records exception does not require...
Well, no, but I want to stay on unavailability for a moment. So are you conceding that was poorly done and that was error?
It was poorly done, Your Honor. However, it was not error. The trial counsel did establish that this witness was unavailable.
And you would say that, as a matter of law, that was adequate, what the trial counsel did?
Yes, Your Honor.
What would be a better way to do it? What should the judge have required in this instance, if anything additional? And what responsibility, if any, did defense counsel have to require more specificity as to availability?
Your Honor, the trial counsel first should have created some type of document detailing his efforts at obtaining this witness and at least remember the names of the people he spoke to. However, he did remember the positions, which is a more important factor for determining whether Silver's going to be released, and did not stop at the battery commander, but continued to talk to the battalion commander and also spoke to the trial counsel.
Well, he didn't speak to the battalion commander, did he?
No, Your Honor.
He says the battery commander spoke with the battalion commander.
Yes, Your Honor. However, the trial counsel in the present case spoke to the military justice shop and the trial counsel for that commander to try to encourage them to bring the soldier to the court-martial.
So documentation, should the judge or the defense counsel, what responsibility does defense counsel have, if any?
The defense counsel would not have had much of a responsibility here because ultimately the burden to show unavailability is on the government. However, availability of a witness is only required if a statement is testimonial. And at present...
No, I understand. I'm testing you on the first threshold. I'm not making you concede everything else. but the thing is, this could be a murder trial. This could be a lot of things. And we're looking at what the law should be over the horizon and not just in this case. And I'm trying to get a sense of whether this is error, and if not error, in any event, how might it be done differently?
It wasn't a model of efficiency for the trial counsel to do it this way. And the trial counsel should have at least proffered evidence about Sergeant Porter's more about Sergeant Porter's position and specifically what in the field artillery unit required him to stay forward. However, the trial counsel did do the proper method by proffering the evidence he had to the military judge. Certainly, there would have been no requirement for somebody from the unit to actually travel to testify about the unavailability.
What about, is there any requirement, or should there be any requirement to consider alternatives to live testimony? This seems to be focused on whether he was going to appear at the trial in person.
Yes, Your Honor, and in the present case, that was done. The trial counsel here, anticipating that Sergeant Porter would not be available, did a telephone deposition to...
So doesn't that cuts both ways, doesn't it? Doesn't that demonstrate that at the trial there might have been an opportunity to do a telephonic appearance as well?
Yeah, there could have been. However, because defense counsel objected to the use of telephonic testimony, it was not an option on the table.
Counsel, if we don't believe that this is a testimonial statement and we agree with you that it falls within the business record exception, do we even reach the issue of unavailability?
No, Your Honor, you do not. If this court determines that the statement was non-testimonial and properly admitted under either the business records exception or the residual hearsay exception, unavailability is immaterial as it is not required under the rules.
Before we leave unavailability, am I correct in taking your answer to stand for the following proposition? That is, the government is not taking the position here, and this is a question, not a statement, that deployment to Iraq is per se, that soldiers who are deployed to Iraq are per se unavailable to testify in courts-martial in the United States.
Correct, Your Honor, that should not be a per se rule.
And
Likewise, the fact that somebody is a squad leader does not per se make that person unavailable to testify.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. With respect to the testimonial aspect, does the record establish what purpose was served by the references to the document being turned over to law enforcement and the individual being willing to testify in a subsequent case? Is this something that we can find in the record, or is it something that we are making assumptions about based upon assumptions about business practices?
No specific testimony about that paragraph. However, there was testimony from Ms. Abens that this affidavit was a pre-printed form required by the bank.
Okay, so what would be, in your view, the business purposes served by those two statements?
Now, the purpose is exactly what Ms. Abens stated on page 59 of the record. This document and the verification is necessary because the bank is giving out money. Before a bank gives out money, it has to do verify the information and...
I'm not asking about the whole statement. I'm asking about those two statements, that the person is going to be willing to testify that in a trial and that the document can be turned over to law enforcement. Are you saying that this document would not fulfill business purposes absent those two items?
It would, Your Honor. However,
then what is the business purpose of those two items?
There are several potential business purposes. First, Your Honor, when asking for an affidavit in a potential forgery case, the bank has an interest to show the person making the claim that this is a serious matter. Additionally, there are privacy concerns. If they, as in this case, law enforcement authorities ask for the record, the bank has to have given notice to the person making the document before they can release it.
Isn't there a federal statute dealing with bank privacy?
I'm sure there is, Your Honor.
I think our court has examined that statute in some somewhat great detail, and I don't believe that an advance waiver is required. It may be helpful, but this document doesn't reference that statute or waiving an individual's right under the statute, does it?
It does not, Your Honor. The document itself is not required by federal law. As Ms. Abens testified, the document is required by bank policy and bank rules.
I'm sorry.
Just one follow-up on that, if I could. Do you know, and you don't have to answer this, and I'm not asking for supplemental briefing, whether this statement would suffice upon a law enforcement request for the document, or would the bank be required to go back to the individual under the federal legislation and obtain a further waiver? Does the record tell us, or do you know from the statute, whether this document is sufficient should there be a law enforcement request? For example, in this case, was it sufficient?
For the law enforcement investigation?
Right. In other words, upon the law enforcement request, was the bank required under federal statute to go back to complainant in this case and obtain a waiver, or was this document then sufficient so that the bank could then provide the information to law enforcement without further proceedings?
I don't know that what the actual federal law states, Your Honor. However, I doubt that any law enforcement agency would tire anyone with an offense such as forgery solely based upon a document.
No, my question is, in this case, does the record tell us anything about whether there were further proceedings under federal legislation to obtain this document, or was this document simply provided to the government without any further notice to the complainant that his bank, that information about his bank account was being turned over to the government?
No, the CID files only indicate that CID requested the all documents from the bank. There's no indication whether certain portal was notified of that.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, I have a question, which is, are you familiar with any case law about parsing out different statements within a business record to ascertain whether each of the statements within it serve a valid business purpose, or is it just whether the document serves a business purpose?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, about that. Looking further at the non-testimonial nature of this document, A third factor this court should consider is that even though Sergeant Porter, at the time that he made this affidavit, knew that appellant was the one who had stolen the money, Sergeant Porter does not name appellant anywhere in this document. If he had wanted to create a document for prosecution, he certainly would have pointed the finger at the person who committed the crime. Additionally, at the time that Sergeant Porter made his affidavit, the law enforcement function had already been completed. Sergeant Porter had already given two detailed statements to CID, giving all the details on the crime and implicating Sergeant Porter. Despite that, there was absolutely no reason for further law enforcement function for him to make this additional affidavit. These four factors point to the conclusion that the primary purpose here was not the creation of evidence with a view towards prosecution. And as this court held in both...
Didn't the judge determine that the affidavit was the sole evidence that this wasn't an authorized signature?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. However, that was done before the military judge actually heard any of the evidence presented by the government. And looking at the full record of trial, there is circumstantial evidence that this was not authorized use by appellant.
What does the record tell us, if anything, about the practice of the bank with respect to these records? And that is, does the bank, once it collects the record, make an affirmative effort to turn these records over to law enforcement? Does the bank wait until it receives a request for law enforcement? Do we have any sense from the record, first in this case, and then secondly, as a general practice?
Now, Ms. Aikens did not testify about the bank's policy. However, we do know from the record that the bank did not forward this information, but rather that CID sought out the information. Looking at this court's questions in Rankin, there was also no law enforcement or prosecutorial involvement at all in the creation of this document. As in Schur, the statement was made to a private individual with not associated at all with the government. And as in Maggiore, this statement was created in a non-adversarial environment, a bank office. Additionally, the statement here did not involve more than routine and objective cataloging of unambiguous factual matters. The affidavit is not subject to more than one interpretation and primarily includes information found on the face of the checks. Looking at these three questions that this court asked in Rankin, the conclusion is that this statement was non-testimonial because the primary purpose was not the creation of evidence for use of prosecution, but the recruitment of money by Sergeant Porter. There was no law enforcement involvement, and the statement did not involve more than routine and objective cataloging of unambiguous matters. Additionally, the military judge properly admitted this affidavit as a business record. This information was not just sent by Sergeant Porter to the bank, but in fact the bank required Sergeant Porter to give him this information, required that it be given in a certain format and in person. Upon receipt of the information, the bank then verified all the information because, as Ms. Aiden stated, the bank has a reason to make sure that this information is true before handing out money. Because the bank verified the information, it pretty much adopted the information, and thus the information was transmitted by a person of knowledge. Additionally, as Ms. Evans testified, the bank was required to keep this affidavit for 7 years in its files and kept the document in the course of its regular business activity. The military judge specifically found that both under the business records exception and the residual hearsay rule, this affidavit was properly admitted. Because the primary purpose of this document was not the creation of evidence, it was non-testimonial and it was properly admitted. Are there any further questions?
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
guess one of the questions that was asked previously, that is why the bank required Sergeant Porter, in this case, to sign the document five times. And I, the record doesn't show what the reason was, but I believe that it's indicative of the fact that this was a document, goes towards the document, I mean, reason that this is a document created for prosecutorial purpose. Normally, business documents, from our common experience, normally don't require five signatures before public notary. And also, as for the primary purpose of the document, then on the face of the document, it is quite clear. And also, if you see, look at the closing argument of the trial counsel and the rebuttal argument, that this document did precisely what a witness should have done in a trial, and that is testifying about a past event and basically testifying about what the elements were. And the trial counsel on page 145 states that we want to have an affidavit, and an affidavit that was signed by Sergeant Porter himself, affidavit that was made under oath, basically what a witness does in a trial. And Sergeant Porter promised that every information, every bit of information in the affidavit was true. Again, what a witness does in a trial. And what is the truth about the affidavit? That he did, that the nine checks that accused him was charged with forging are the nine checks that Sergeant Porter claims were forged on his account. This is not an ambiguous cataloging of facts, Your Honor. If you consider the business record reasoning for business record exception for hearsay, yet it is the regularity, the habit of which the record was made, that gives the presumption of accuracy. Unless Sergeant Porter is the one that has a habit of going around and signing such a forgery affidavit at all the bank accounts that he has, then it certainly would not be the case, Your Honor. The formality, considering the formality of the document, and you know, the fact that Sergeant Porter was required to appear before the bank, sign it five times, swear to its truth under oath before a public notary, and also on the face of the document, it clearly states that this will be used for law enforcement and for prosecutorial purpose, and that prosecutors will be relying on it, makes it a document that was created for litigation. As the Sixth Circuit Court in U.S. v. Sanders stated, courts do not convict by affidavit, Your Honor. And in this case, allowing this affidavit to be introduced in trial, to borrow the words of the Supreme Court, would be a rule of perversion to rule designed to provide procedural guarantee of witnesses' trustworthiness by testing in the crucible of cross-examination. And that simply wasn't done in this case, Your Honor. So the appellant, first of all, appreciates the time and the attention that this court is providing to the case, and would respectfully request that the court grant the requested relief.
Thank you, counsel. The case is now submitted, and we thank counsel for both parties for your argument today. And the court will stand in recess until 10 minutes before 10 o'clock. Our second case this morning is United States against Hollings. This case is set for 15 minutes per side. Counsel for the defense.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Brian Miser, and I represent the appellate private first class, Derek Hollings. Chief Judge, I've come with your permission. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
That's granted.
When Secretary of Defense Forrestal addressed Congress about the proposed Uniform Code of Military Justice in March of 1949, he expressed his belief that the code struck the proper balance between maximum military performance and maximum justice. With respect to maximum military performance, the code contained a still controversial provision, Article 25, which allows the military commander to select the members of a court-martial. To ensure maximum justice, this court has held the challenges to those members should be liberally granted. Appellant's charges were preferred and referred to a special court martial in February 2003 while Chief Warrant Officer 5W was assisting the squadron legal officer with her duties and performing some of those duties in her absence. On page 71 of the record of trial, he states that he had daily interactions with the squadron legal officer during the second half of his working day. The legal officer, First Lieutenant Hernandez, quote, if she needed something from me in support of her legal actions, or if I had the certified unit diaries recording the completed legal action, I would do that, end quote.
Is any a personnel officer?
He is, in fact, a personnel officer.
Isn't that what personnel officers do?
I would say no, Your Honor, in this
personnel
case.
Officers don't fill out unit diaries?
Well, they do fill out unit diaries, Your Honor, and he testifies to that, but not those with respect to the legal officer or legal functions. We're dealing with the unit punishment book here, functions that are within the purview of the legal officer. Because he's been a legal officer in the past.
Personnel officers do not fill out unit diaries reflecting legal matters?
Well, Your Honor, he accurately states that that's a function of the legal officer. It is her duty, and I think that is an accurate statement of the function and role of the legal officer. In addition, he's supporting her in other tasks. On page 71, he says, I supported her in other functions in addition to certifying those unit diaries. So he is, in fact, assisting the legal officer in accomplishing her duties for the squadron.
It's like the artillery officer who supports the infantry officer. He becomes an infantry officer because he supports the infantry officer.
I suppose the analogy would be here.
So all artillery officers are infantry officers. In the Marine Corps, they aren't, but let's say you're in the Army.
No, Your Honor. If this were the traditional role of him just performing the traditional artillery function pursuant to your analogy, then no, we would not be making this argument. But he's in the trenches with the infantry officer in this case, and he plainly says that on page 71 of the record of trial.
What is there in the record that shows that he acted as legal officer in this case?
Well, Your Honor, this court is going to have to, we're dealing with the per se disqualification issue pursuant to 912G, is going to have
to... Yeah, isn't that all that was at issue at trial?
It was not.
I don't think they raised anything but 912G.
That's true, Your Honor. But this court has held in Armstrong and most recently in Clay that the military judge should also conduct that implied bias test, regardless of what the actual challenge was, whether it was actual bias or one of these per se disqualifying factors, such as 912G. So the military judge had the obligation, whether or not he agreed ultimately with the defense's challenge that this was, or Chief Warrant Officer 5W was in fact a legal officer, to then test his presence for implied bias. And that's really where the central problem is with this case, is on the grounds of implied bias. This court should expect nothing less than a seasoned legal officer like Chief Warrant Officer 5W to assist and mentor the first lieutenant, the young junior officer, who is in fact a Desiree legal officer. But this court should also expect a military judge, pursuant to the liberal grant mandate, to grant a challenge for cause to that legal officer.
Counsel, I'm sorry. If a personnel officer is required to certify the unit diary in every instance, would you agree with that proposition that the unit diary needs to be certified or needs to be manipulated by a personnel officer?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you suggesting that because then any legal matters will be contained within the unit diary that the personnel officer will ultimately certify, that personnel officers are barred from serving on court-martials?
No, Your Honor.
Of units in which a member of their command is being court-martialed?
No, Your Honor, not at all. That's not what we have in this case. We have an individual who is not only certifying unit diaries, he's assisting the legal officer in this case. And if you also look to page 64 of the voir dire, you have him testifying about his previous experience as a legal officer. He says he was a squadron legal officer. The role that First Lieutenant Hernandez, is filling in this bullet. And also on that page, he also says how he assisted the legal officer at the infantry battalion on his next tour in his function as a legal officer, applying his training of the legal officer. And that's precisely what we have here again. He is acting in a quasi-legal officer role here, doing something that not the artilleryman does, not the personnel officer does, but acting as a legal officer, supporting her interactions, not in a personnel
When you say supporting her in her actions, can you describe with specificity what exactly it is that you're referring to? Because I'm not sure I understand the distinction between supporting her in her actions and as opposed to simply doing what it is that personnel officers do.
Well, I can only refer you to page 71 of the record trial, where Chief Warrant Officer 5W tells you what he means by that. If she needed something from me in support of her legal actions, or if I had to certify you in the diaries myself, recording complete legal action, I would do that. And so we don't know with specificity what he means by supporting legal actions, but in light of the liberal...
There's all kinds of people on the base can support the legal officer.
Certainly, Your Honor.
Paralegals, people who type, the guy who fixes the fuse box so that she's got light. How far does this go?
Well, Your Honor, it goes as far as those that are, in fact, supporting the legal officer in these legal functions. And that, I think that's a plain reading of what page 71 says that he was doing. He says that he's done that before. On page 64, he's assisted squadron legal officers, and in fact, he is a legal officer. And then we're dealing with a very junior first lieutenant, brand new to the Marine Corps,
Well, is it your contention that her will was overborne by this guy's experience?
It is not, Your Honor. But
well, then why do you keep talking about mentoring and her junior status?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's important because what we have here is a very senior, probably 25-year veteran of the Marine Corps who is an experienced legal officer and is, in essence, assisting this young officer in performing her duties. And so that's why we know that this isn't just the personnel officer who has been triple-handed and is just fulfilling the office of the personnel officer. He's supporting this young legal officer in fulfilling the functions of the legal officer. And from that standpoint, it's a violation of 912G, but more importantly, with implied bias. And the facts of this case are very similar to those in Phillips v. Smith, where the district court found implied bias, where Veneerman had simply applied for a position with the prosecutor's office. And in this case, you have a Veneerman who states that on a daily basis, he worked with the battalion, or the squadron legal officer, pardon me, and supported her in her duties. The Justice Rehnquist, writing for four other members of the court, disagreed with the district court and established precedent dating to Chief Justice John Marshall's 1807 opinion in the treason trial of Aaron Burr, and held that the Constitution did not recognize the concept of implied bias. Writing separately in an opinion that has been often cited by this court, Justice O'Connor wrote that implied bias should be reserved for extreme situations. One of those extreme situations that she lists is when a juror is an employee in the prosecutor's office, and that is precisely what we have here. We have that daily interaction with the legal officer, and from the public's perception of fairness in the military justice system, it cannot be tolerated.
But Burr was an actual bias case, wasn't it?
I believe it was, Your Honor, although... In the first two paragraphs, there is this famous discussion by Chief Justice Marshall about implied bias.
You would agree that assisting the legal officer is different than working in the prosecutor's office, wouldn't you?
I don't know that that distinction is present in this case. We have that daily interaction with the legal officer, and he's performing some of the functions of the legal officer in her absence.
Well, let me start with a smaller proposition. You would agree that the legal officer is not the prosecutor, right?
Well, Your Honor, she has, with the convening authority, the most important prosecutorial power, which is prosecutorial discretion. The trial counsel, the individual that is going into court, is the lesser piece of the prosecution puzzle in military justice.
Okay, another question. We're testing implied bias for abuse of discretion, correct?
That's right, Your Honor.
And so my question for you is, even assuming that I didn't believe that it was waived, if it wasn't obvious enough that the trial defense counsel raised it, even though they obviously knew that there was such a thing, since the next juror that came up they challenged based on implied bias, how did the military judge abuse their discretion?
Well, Your Honor, in light of Armstrong and Clay, the military judge should have tested this challenge for cause from an appearance standpoint. And this case is very similar to Clay, which was decided earlier this term, when the military judge made no mention of either implied bias or the liberal grant mandate. It's on all fours with with this case. Actual bias was raised in that case, not implied bias, and this court held that the military judge abused his discretion in not addressing implied bias or the liberal grant mandate. But unlike Clay, this is not a closed case. The court held, as the court held in Weissing, issues of implied bias are appropriately viewed in the context of the public perceptions of a system in which the commander who exercises prosecutorial discretion is the official who also selects and structures the panel that will hear the case. The appearance of military justice, maximum justice in the words of Secretary of Defense Forrestal, cannot tolerate the service of a veneerman who dutifully fulfills both the function in the prosecutor's office, assisting the prosecutor's office, and also sits on the member's panel.
Is it your position, are you basically stating a per se rule that any time someone's a challenge is lodged, the judge has to test for implied bias?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's a clear implication of Clay and Armstrong. Separate legal tests, not legal challenges, is the language that I'm relying upon. And again, in Clay, implied bias was not raised by the defense.
That was an actual bias.
It was actual bias.
Well, that's not this case.
It is not, Your Honor. It is a per se challenge, per se disqualification to the legal officer. But the military judge should have tested for implied bias. And the defense counsel's failure to address it is of no consequence.
Why is a per se disqualification necessarily actual bias?
Your Honor, I see the amount of time if I can answer your question, and if you could just repeat it.
Why is a per se disqualification the same as actual bias?
Well, Your Honor, it raises some of the central some of the same issues that are addressed in Justice O'Connor's opinion. That you wouldn't expect Chief Warrant Officer 5W to come in and say, yes, I'm the legal officer, and that makes me per se disqualified, in the same way that you wouldn't expect, say, the member in Clay to say, I would be merciless within the extent of the full extent of the law, and I can't listen to your instructions, Your Honor. We have to test all of these challenges for perception, and therefore implied bias should also come as part of the per se challenges.
I understand your answer. Thank you. Counsel for the government.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Captain Roger Mattioli, and I represent the United States. Quote, I didn't act as legal officer. I certified unit diaries. I didn't request legal services. I didn't type group non-judicial punishments, other unit punishment books. I didn't go in for courts martial or office hours. I didn't give the CO any opinions or legal recommendations. That's record at page 72. Those are the words of Chief Warrant Officer 5W, the station personnel officer, when he was asked directly if he acted as the legal officer when the station legal officer, Captain Fernandez, was unavailable. Chief Warrant Officer 5W did not act as the legal officer, and in fact, he had not acted as a Marine Corps...
Counsel, the defense has essentially conceded that he didn't act as the legal officer in this case. How do you answer their contention that the judge had an independent duty to inquire into implied bias?
Your Honor, if that is the case, if in fact the per se disqualifications do call into question the doctrine of implied bias, then we have to throw out the term legal officer and just look at the facts in this case, because the language legal officer, which is relied on in appellant's brief, is the language from the per se 912 F1 G and H. So therefore, now we're not dealing with the fact of whether or not he was a legal officer to the convening authority, which he clearly was not. Now this court is simply looking at the facts and surrounding circumstances of the case to determine whether or not...
Well, he's claiming that the military judge had an independent duty, regardless of whether the issue was raised, and it clearly wasn't, to inquire into implied bias. How do you answer that?
The case law is not clear on that, Your Honor. It is clear that when it's an actual bias case, and for argument's sake, it would seem that that if we're going to look at actual bias challenges under this doctrine of implied bias, that that would also be the case for the per se rules. However, that there is no case law to base that upon. And clearly, the military judge in this case correctly ruled that there was no per se, no grounds for a per se challenge. Chief Warrant Officer 5W was not the staff judge advocate.
Well, wait a minute. Are you conceding that he had an independent duty to inquire and implied bias?
We're not conceding, Your Honor. However, we do recognize that all of the case law on actual bias.
Well, this isn't actual bias.
It is not, Your Honor.
So is your argument that if it doesn't fall into one of the per se disqualifications, which in this case, if he wasn't a legal officer, it does not, that it doesn't matter in this case whether you have to then test for implied bias or not?
I'm sorry,
that wasn't a very clear question. Is your argument that even if there were to be a per se rule, that if there was a challenge based on the per se disqualifications, that here this warrant officer doesn't fall within the per se disqualification, so you don't have to test for implied bias?
Yeah, that is not my argument.
Okay.
That was simply in response to the question that the case law is unclear as to whether the per se qualification or disqualifications call into question implied bias. It's clear that a challenge for actual bias does.
Okay.
And so therefore, logically, it would seem that the court would test for implied bias. However, again, that's not clear from the case law. And it's not germane to the issue before this court because in this case, clearly, the appellant under an implied bias standard has not met his burden of showing that a member of the public would find that the military justice system was unfair because of the presence of Chief Warrant Officer W.
Well, how can we know that? The question was never raised. The judge never ruled. There's nothing in the record on it. So how can we know that?
That is correct, Your Honor. However, looking at this case through the standard on implied bias cases, the appellant still fails to reach his burden. Looking at the facts and circumstances, again, the language is the facts and circumstances surrounding the case of showing that, under the totality of the circumstances, the public will perceive the trial as unfair. That's Downing. This court has made clear that when looking at a case of implied bias, it is reviewed under standard review as less deferential than abuse of discretion, more deferential than de novo. But even a de novo review of this case, looking at the facts as they are laid out clearly in the record, shows that Chief Warrant Officer 5W, his presence on the panel would not have contributed to an appearance of unfairness.
What do you make of the argument, as I understood it, that appellant's counsel made, that somehow that the admin officer is akin to the legal officer, is akin to the prosecutor?
That is absolutely incorrect, Your Honor. They are separate billets. They are completely separate. Now,
well, incorrect that that was his argument, or incorrect that that's in fact the case?
That was his argument.
Okay.
That was his argument. That is an incorrect statement of the duties of the legal officer and of the personnel officer. And in Chief Warrant Officer 5W, he doesn't go on a great dissertation of what his responsibilities are as personnel officer, but he does have knowledge of what the duties are of the legal officer. And that is the quote that I started my argument with, which is that the only thing he did was certify unit diaries. He makes clear at page 72 that is a job that the legal officer can perform, but it is a job that the personnel officer is required to perform. That is his job as personnel officer. And simply because these two separate billets, either one of them may perform this one action, doesn't mean that he is acting as a legal officer when he's taking those actions. He makes clear that he certified unit diaries and he was CC'd on the report, which listed the status of all of the personnel on base that were not in a regular duty status. Those two facts do not raise to the level of a challenge for implied bias.
What do you make of the suggestion that the legal officers, understanding that the warrant officer you say is not the legal officer, what do you make of the suggestion that the legal officer has greater prosecutorial discretion than the prosecutor?
That is also an incorrect statement, Your Honor. In fact, the legal officer under that analogy doesn't even work in the prosecutor's office. The Marine Corps legal officer in the prosecutor's office at a Marine Corps air station, you would have the staff judge advocate to the convening authority, and that again is the individual that is contemplated by Rule 912 F1 GMH. That person certainly has supervisory power over the trial counsel, who would be the prosecutor. The legal officer is normally not an attorney and is someone who works in the squadron, not in the legal center, and so they would not be working in the prosecutor's office.
Counsel, with respect to the comments that you just made, are those matters that are established in regulation or documents of which we can take notice, or are they your own personal observations?
They are. I'm not aware if they are available on the table of authorities for the Marine Corps. They certainly the organization of a Marine Corps Law Center is set out, and certainly I could provide that to that court, to this court.
If it's set out in a regulation or a published document, we can find that. The term legal officer, what does that mean in the code, in the manual, and does it have a different meaning in the Marine Corps?
The term legal officer under 912 refers to in the Marine Corps, the staff judge advocate to the convening authority. A Marine Corps legal officer is not the same as a Navy legal officer who sometimes has the same responsibilities as the staff judge advocate to advise the convening authority to specifically, under 912 F1H, provide the post-trial recommendation, what is either called the staff judge advocate's recommendation in the Marine Corps or the legal officer's recommendation in the Navy. In the Marine Corps, a legal officer, non-lawyer, does not prepare the post-trial recommendation for the convening authority.
Is the short answer that a legal officer in the Marine Corps is not a legal officer, as that term is used in the code and manual?
Okay.
Well, what do you base that on?
Your Honor, the language of the statute, again, 912, the definitions that are provided, if I could have one moment. Legal officer is determined in the index of the code. It says see also staff judge advocate, and defines staff judge advocate and a judge advocate as an attorney. Article 60 lists the responsibilities of the staff judge advocate or legal officer and lays them out regarding the recommendations to the convening authority. Article 34 does the same, discusses the staff judge advocate or legal officer to the convening authority in terms of they are responsible for providing the recommendation, post-trial recommendation, what we refer to as the SJAR or the LOR. So that is the language that the government is relying on.
How about Article 1, subsection 12?
Yes, Your Honor. Article 1 states that the legal officer is any commissioned officer of the Marine Corps designated to perform legal duties for command.
Okay. Was this individual designated to perform legal duties for the command?
Yes, they were.
So, aren't they a legal officer then?
They are not, as 912 contemplates it, Your Honor. It is clear from
I'm looking at the statute, because it would, under normal concepts of construction, the statute governs over the manual.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, if somebody is a legal officer under Article 1, Section 12, why wouldn't they be a legal officer under the manual for courts-martial?
Your Honor, because Rule for Court-Martial 912 talks about a legal officer or staff judge advocate taking action, either having acted or taking action in the case. And so therefore, just the fact that they held this legal officer billet does not disqualify them under that per se rule.
Well, that's a different answer, and that is that he wasn't a legal officer in this case, and therefore doesn't fall in the per se rule. Not that he wasn't a legal officer. In other words, 912G applies to someone who has acted in the same case as convening authority or as the legal officer or staff judge advocate to the convening authority. Literally, that doesn't preclude someone who is a convening authority legal officer or staff judge advocate from sitting as a member of a court martial so long as they did not act in that particular case. Yes, Your Honor. In that capacity.
Yes, Your Honor. And, again, the case law cited by the government is brief.
So if somebody's a staff judge advocate to the convening authority and happens to be on leave when a particular case goes through for pretrial advice, is there no implied bias issue if that person is then picked to be the court-martial member in subsequent in the case that he was at, he or she was absent on, even if they have advised the convening authority on every other case that came through?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The key language there is under implied bias. They're not under Rule 912. Okay.
So there is a potential then for an implied bias issue to arise based on someone's status in the command, even if they're not literally disqualified under the specific rules.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely. And the government's argument is that under that, just looking at that implied bias, again, setting aside 912, how clearly this individual didn't take action and was not the staff judge advocate to the convening authority, just looking from an implied bias standpoint, the facts are that he specifically on the record stated that he was not a legal officer, that he did not take any of those actions that a legal officer takes, that the only actions he took were to certify unit diary entries.
And was he designated to perform legal duties in his present billet for this command?
No, he was not.
Okay.
No, he was not.
He was not.
In fact,
he had been in the past for other commands.
About a decade prior, yes, Your Honor.
But he was not designated. This is not a designator that goes with your MOS or AFSC as you proceed through the Marine Corps.
No, Your Honor. He did have included that he had attended the legal officer's course.
So when you responded to Chief Judge Efron that he was a legal officer, was that for the purposes of Article 1, is that a correct statement?
He technically meets the definition of a commissioned officer. No, that is not correct. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I was mistaken. He is not designated to perform legal duties. I apologize. I misspoke myself. He certainly, in this case, was not designated to perform legal duties for the command. Perhaps Captain Fernandez was designated to perform legal duties, and that's where my confusion came in. I apologize to the
Thank you.
For that. There are... This court has found implied bias in a number of cases recently, most importantly, United States versus Moreno, where it found that a potential member or the president who ended up being president of the board investigated the charges, weighed facts, made recommendations based on his conclusions, and continued to follow appellant's case and appellant's co-accused in the press. In United States versus Clay, this court stated that where the officer indicated he would be merciless within the limits of the law, that that was a close case. As the appellant pointed out earlier, this case is not a close case. If Chief Warrant Officer Westfall had actually been a squadron officer, then I see that I'm out of time. If I
may take a brief conclusion.
Thank you, Your Honor. If he had been the legal officer, the designated legal officer, or had taken some action in appellant's case, it might be a closer call. But appellant can't even prove those facts. The only facts he can show is that Chief Warrant Officer 5W was the personnel officer and that he specifically stated he was not the legal officer. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have a rebuttal?
On page 72 of the record of trial, Chief Warrant Officer Westfall discusses what a Marine Corps legal officer does in his perception. He's been to the Naval Justice School and has been trained as a legal officer. Requesting legal services, group NJPs, UPBs. I didn't go in for courts, marshals, or office hours. I also didn't give the CO any opinions or legal recommendations. And that would appear to be very similar to a staff judge advocate for this small
unit. Counsel, just to see if there's any disagreement on this between the government and the defense. The government, in response to the clarifying questions, stated that he was not assigned as a legal officer in the case. I understand the argument you're making that the duties amounted to, but is there agreement between the parties that he was not literally assigned to the position of a legal officer?
Designated pursuant to Article 1, Clause 12. Did he perform legal duties pursuant to that clause? Yes, Your Honor. But he was not, pursuant to the plain language of that statute, designated to perform legal duties. And in that case, if that language is narrowly construed, the paralegal that worked daily for the legal officer and stood at captain's mast would also be permitted to sit at as a member on courts martial, which is very very similar to the situation that we have here with Chief Warrant Officer.
Well, a paralegal can't be a legal officer because he's not commissioned.
Fair point, Your Honor. Yes. But we're really dealing with, the point is we're dealing with someone who is working in the legal office, working in the office of the prosecutor, who ultimately then sits on the panel. The same thing with Smith, someone who had filed that application with the prosecutor's office, was later sitting in the jury box across from the accused. In this case, is much worse. You have someone with that daily interaction with the legal officer on legal issues. If there are no further questions, I thank the court for its time.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties. And the court will recess until 10:30.
For you, or you want
Our third case this morning is United States against Pfluger. This is a 15-minute per side case. Counsel for the defense.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Richard McWilliams, and I represent the appellant, Lance Gerald R. Pfluger III, U.S. Marine Corps. Now, with the court's permission, I preserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
It's granted.
The lower court found that the 1,376 days which passed between sentencing and docketing of the appellant's case was unreasonable and thus entitled to appellant to some relief. Accordingly, the lower court set aside the appellant's remitted bad conduct discharge as that relief. The issue before the court today is whether, under Article 58 B.C., the remission of a bad conduct discharge entitles the appellant to the return of automatic forfeitures. Article 58 B.C. provides the return of such forfeitures if the triggering sentence is set aside, disapproved, or as finally approved is not provided for. This morning, the court must interpret whether that language, set aside, disapproved, or as finally approved is not provided for, encompasses remission. Appellant's position is that of these three situations, setting aside, disapproving, or as finally approving, and not provided for, that remission is encompassed by the second and third clauses, the disapproved clause and the as finally approved, not provided for clause.
Counsel, in the convening authority's action, he approved the bad conduct discharge, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. However, the statute, Article 58 B.C., delineates between approval and final approval. The inclusion of that language finally in the statute seems to indicate that the decision, the deciding factor, the bright line test, was not really what was contained in the convening authority's action, but what the sentence as finally approved, that is, at the end of the day, the completion of appellate review encompasses. And if it does include a triggering punishment, then there are no return forfeitures. If it is not, then it should be
approved. What happens when a fine is remitted?
When a fine is remitted?
Yes, if you fine $200, you pay $100, and then the fine is remitted. Do you get does that terminate the second $100 and you get back the first $100, or do you just don't have to pay the second $100?
I believe in the RCM 1108A, it would just simply cancel the unexecuted portion. That is, you would not get the paid $100 back, Your Honor, but it would cancel
the remainder.
The remainder, yes, Your Honor.
Is there something to be, how would that parallel and apply in this, to this case, if at all?
Well,
if we're trying to figure out what it means to remit something.
Yes, Your Honor. The critical difference in this situation, we're dealing with the remission of a triggering punishment under Article 58 B.A. and the case that Your Honor is speaking of, the remission of a fine, is that we're talking about triggering punishments and whether or not they exist for the purposes of Article 58 B.A. for the purposes of Article 58 B.C. Article 58 B.C. says that we have these triggering punishments and they either exist or they don't exist. If the bad conduct discharge is remitted, therefore canceled, it ceases to exist for the purposes of Article 58 B.A. and therefore brings the appellant's case from the article.
As of what time does it cease to exist?
It ceases to exist at the time that it's remitted, which is, in this case, was 1 year after the convening authority acted.
Where does Article 58 mention remission at all?
I believe, Your Honor, appellant contends that it falls under the as finally approved, not provided for clause. Before Article 58 B.C. was drafted, Senator Nunn, in addressing Senator Boxer's proposal, says, well, what impact shall the commander's decision to suspend a sentence have in this? After Senator Nunn asked that question, the bill is drafted, and the language is, as it says, set aside, disapproved, or as finally approved, not provided for it. It is not explicitly mentioned, Your Honor. However, the appellant contends that the inclusion of that as finally approved, and particularly that word finally, as we know, the convening authority is an act once and then act again. There has to be some sort of declaration of final approval, and that's what the appellant believes, how the appellant contends remission is handled by the statute.
It isn't as finally approved, doesn't that refer to the final approval for execution of a BCD or a DD after a case has been, such a case has been reviewed by this court or by the lower court of criminal appeals?
I believe the statute refers to as final approval does not provide for a sentence which falls under Article 58 B alpha. I believe that talking about is more fairly says, encompassed by the set-aside clause. I think that the Congress's inclusion of the term set-aside, and or disapproved for that matter, encompasses appellate review. The inclusion of that term as finally approved encompasses also appellate review, but also the ultimate disposition of the case and whatever sentence is left in the final review of the case, Your Honor.
Well, if the convening authority orders any part of the sentence to be remitted, what happens to that part of the sentence when it comes to the Court of Criminal Appeals under Article 66? What does the Court of Criminal Appeals do with that part of the sentence? Let's say that the convening authority has ordered the BCD in any case to be remitted. The conditions for remission have now been met. What does the Court of Criminal Appeals do at that point?
First of all, it does have jurisdiction, Your Honor. Our 6B1 says the trigger for jurisdiction would be simply approval. The sentence must simply be approved by the convening authority in order to trigger jurisdiction. The Canadian Marine Corps Court of Criminal Appeals, for example, has modified or evolved this position as to what it should do with that punishment. In Olinger and Deard, where the punishment was remitted by the Naval Clemency and Parole Board, it did indicate that discharge ceased to exist, and therefore the line or the sentence which is sought to review for sentence appropriateness under Article 66 was the sentence existed without a bad conduct discharge. Following Gaines, however, it seems to indicate that it will consider remitted bad conduct discharges for the purposes of sentence appropriateness and ultimately to determine whether or not the meaningful relief can be developed by remitting such bad conduct discharges. In this case, the local did in fact remove that bad conduct discharge.
That's not my question. Putting aside any action that the court may take for legal or sentence appropriateness matters, when the Court of Criminal Appeals finally acts on a case under Article 66C, what does the court say when a discharge has been remitted and the remission conditions have been met? Does it approve the sentence with the inclusion of the discharge, or does it approve the sentence less the discharge?
Well, it's saying less the discharge, Your Honor. For example, the Navy Marine Corps Court held in Olinger and Deter, that discharge ceased to exist upon the day of remission. If the discharge has been remitted before the lower court takes the case, as occurred in this case, where remission occurs years before the lower court even begins its review, it should say that we approve the sentence as approved by the convening authority, less the bad conduct discharge, which was remitted on, in this case, February 1st.
Have you encountered any cases in which a Court of Criminal Appeals or any of its predecessors has taken a case in which a sentence has been remitted, part of the sentence has been remitted, and that remission condition has been met, and the Court of Criminal Appeals nonetheless approves the sentence that it would include that remitted matter rather than removing the remitted matter? Whereas when the court says, here's the sentence that we approve, because if we're talking about what's ultimately going to go on to Article 71 for execution of the sentence and to Article 76 for finality, what words are used by the Court of Criminal Appeals at that point?
No, I have not encountered a case such as that. I have encountered the exact contrary, where they did consider it and ultimately disapproved that sentence on other grounds, such as Indy, which is a Coast Guard Court of Criminal Appeals case, and Spradley, which is a Navy case, where for other reasons they decided to consider and then ultimately disapprove a remitted bad conduct discharge. But I have not found one where they ultimately, and of their own volition, approve an already remitted discharge. I just haven't found one. That does not.
What authority would there be for the Court of Criminal Appeals to approve a discharge that has been remitted where the remission conditions have been met? I'm not talking about them disapproving it for any legal reason, any sense appropriateness reasons, just case simple case of remission.
I would think that there is none, Your Honor. As 1108 says, once a punishment has been remitted, it is canceled. And as the Navy Marine Corps itself held in 1997 until release of an order, such punishments then cease to exist upon remission. Accordingly, in this case, consider facts such as this case where remission occurs years ahead of when the case is ultimately docketed before the lower court. The lower court should have said that there is no bad conduct discharge in this case and not a bad for the client. But anyway.
Appellate jurisdiction attaches at the time of original approval.
That's
in other words, if the convening authority disapproves the BCD, then they're in the Article 66, assuming you have less than a year's confinement. There's no Article 66 review.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Right. But if he turns around 2 days later, remits it, there is.
There's still jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor. That's what I'm asking.
Yes, Your Honor. And that's because the triggering language, in Article 66b1 says the sentence as approved.
As approved, yeah. But the question is, what's approved?
Right, yes, Your Honor.
And as of when?
And that's what it's going to compel this court to evaluate that, what the insertion of that word finally by Congress in Article 58bc means. That word finally must mean something. And the appellant contends that the word inclusion of that word finally means that there must be a bright line test established by this court to say that at the conclusion of review, an appellant either has a triggering punishment for Article 58b(a) or does not. And if they do not, then they should have their automatic forfeitures returned.
But isn't it finally approved? I mean, isn't it not finally approved at the point in time that Chief Judge Efron's talking about when it goes to the Court of Criminal Appeals and it's not approved?
I would say that as finally approved, it does not provide for the BCD. The relevant time for the appellate case for the as final approval is the conclusion of the appellate review, the ultimate case of disposition, not at the time of document. The reason for that being is that we look at the Congress's comments, Senator Nunn's question is what effect then if the commander has to suspend the trigger of punishment. From that, Congress develops this as final approval language, which seems to indicate that it recognizes the convening authority's latitude. Your Honor, see, I'm out of time.
I'll have an opportunity during rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for the government.
May it please the court, my name is Lieutenant David Lee, and I represent the government in this case. The appellant here is arguing that the remission of his adjudged bad conduct discharge entitles him to the return of automatic forfeitures, and as such, the subsequent disapproval of that discharge by the lower court constituted sham relief. This is all in an effort to obtain additional relief from this court, which is not only undeserved, but also legally unjustified. The appellant's argument fails because it goes against the plain meaning of the statute. Second, it goes against relevant most recent case law. And three, the legislative intent does not support his position. First, the plain meaning goes against the appellant. Remission is not the same as disapproval. As the lower court in this case said, it doesn't reduce the sentence adjudged or the sentence approved. In short, it does not put the appellant in the same position that he would have been in had this discharge not been adjudged in the first place.
Counsel, can the Court of Criminal Appeals approve a sentence in which the convening authority has ordered remission of the punitive discharge and the punitive discharge circumstances for remission have been met?
The lower court in a recent case of United States v. Gaines involved a case where the lower court was reviewing the case of legal error, and it had noted that part of the sentence had the bad kind of discharge had already been remitted. Excuse me, part of the confinement had been remitted by the convening authority in excess of 12 months in that case. In the Gaines case, NMCCA ruled that this was still, they were not limited by the fact that the convening authority remitted that excess of 12 months.
So did the Court of Criminal Appeals then approve a sentence in excess of 12 months in that case?
Your Honor, the government government would have to check on that, but it did say that it was not restricted by the fact that it could be...
I understand that. My recollection, and I would have to check that again too, is that I have not encountered a case, although there may be one out there, in which there's been a completed remission in which the Court of Criminal Appeals approved a remitted sentence so that a person, let's say, who was sentenced to 15 months and the remission was 9 months, that the Court of Criminal Appeals, instead of approving a sentence of 6 months, would approve a sentence of 15 months. I haven't encountered a case like that, but again, I'm asking whether the government is aware of any such case.
Well, the government is not aware of any cases.
So in this, let's assume there's a no-error case in which the convening authority has ordered remission of a punitive discharge. The individual, as there's confinement involved, so the individual forfeits pay while in confinement. At the end of the day, when the case goes through and the punitive discharge has been remitted, is the individual entitled to a return of pay under Article 58 B.C.?
No, Your Honor, because it goes against the plain meaning of the statute. That third phrase, appellant is trying to use a third phrase, the as approved does not provide for, and is implying that that's some sort of catch-all phrase that encompasses remission. However, it much more accurately would deal with a case where only part of a sentence is approved on appellate review. For example, if there was an appellant with 10 drug pops, and upon appellate review, 9 of them were thrown out, if the court then decided to only to reduce the sentence so it fell below the threshold of the Article 58 Bravo Charlie punishment, at that point, as approved, does not provide for.
Well, even, let me ask you a slightly different question.
Yes, sir.
Even if I agree with you that remission, that remission is one thing and disapproval is another, the question, one question that we're, I think, trying to answer here is whether the disapproval of the BCD was meaningful relief, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if they could not approve the BCD, and by operation of law, it was going to be disapproved whether they wanted to do something, whether there was this post-trial appellate delay issue or not, how is it meaningful relief to do exactly what they would have had to do anyway?
Your Honor, the government's contention is that because the simple fact of remission does not entitle the appellant to return of his forfeitures.
That's a different question. I'm giving you that. I agree with you on that. We're now at a different point, which is if all that they have done is exactly what they had to do, whether there was this post-trial delay issue or not, how is it meaningful relief for the post-trial delay?
Your Honor, it's meaningful relief. If you look at the dictionary definition of meaningful, and for example, Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, it's defined as tangible. In this case, it is meaningful relief in the sense that it's tangible relief and it's appropriate relief under the circumstances.
But if it's relief that he would have gotten whether he had a post-trial delay issue or not, I mean, does the relief have to be tied to the claim or not? I mean, you're suggesting that it doesn't, as long as there's relief in the air, so to speak, that's meaningful.
Your Honor, in this case, the relief was tied to the claim of post-trial delay because, again, the remission by the convening authority did not entitle them to the return. It was due to the post-trial delay that the court, the lower court, decided disapproved the discharge, and that was the trigger, not only the lower court in this case, but also the Coast Guard Court of Criminal Appeals in the injury case. And again, the government suggested that does constitute meaningful relief when you look at the complete circumstance of the case, including the fact that this appellant has a second bad conduct discharge from a separate court martial, and that the prejudice the appellant suffered is a factor to be weighed when the court determines what appropriate relief is. And the government's position is that that relief provided by the lower court is appropriate for the circumstances of the case.
Try it again. If an individual who has no claim of error in the case has a remitted discharge, can that discharge be executed under Article 71?
Yes, Your Honor, if he violates the terms of his suspension.
No suspension. It's been remitted.
Yeah.
If it's been remitted.
It's been remitted, and you get to Article 71. It can't be. And if there's no discharge approved under Article 71, what happens to the pay that he's been forfeited, that he's forfeited under Article 58BC?
Your Honor, the forfeited funds would still, the appellant would not be entitled to a return of his forfeited funds, even in a case where there was no error and the convening authority remitted the discharge. Even though he clearly cannot reintroduce or execute this remitted discharge on him, the fact that the forfeitures were part of an approved sentence, the fact that the bad kind of discharge was initially approved was the trigger that called for forfeitures, relief regarding forfeitures.
I don't think anyone's quibbling with you about that. I think that it's a slightly different question, which is, if it couldn't be approved and he was going to be entitled to, they could not approve the bad conduct discharge, right? And if on review under 58BC, it was going to not be finally approved so that he would be entitled under 58BA1 or 2 or whatever to get the forfeitures back, how is saying that that's what we're going to give him for his post-trial appellate delay meaningful relief? If it's what he was entitled to, whether he raised a claim about post-trial appellate delay or not. Do you understand the point or the question that I have?
Your Honor, perhaps I'm not following completely.
I don't know if it's clear to any. I think I'm being as clear as I know how to be, and I'm sorry if that isn't clear enough. But it's sort of like if someone owes me $100 and I sue them for, and I have another complaint against them, and they give me nothing other than what I was already entitled to, how have I gotten relief for the other thing I've complained about?
The appellant, again, if the government's position is the appellant didn't have that claim for forfeitures when the convening authority remitted his discharge. That claim did not exist yet. That claim only existed upon its subsequent disapproval. Again, looking at the plain language of the statute, a convening authority...
Why don't you argue based on a timeline? And show us a timeline with respect to his EAS, the remission, and final approval, and indicate at what point different things occur.
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, the convening authority took action on February 1st of 2000. Now, at that point, the convening authority had the right, the government had the right to take these funds from him. 1 year later, that discharge, as part of the previous convening authority's action, was remitted. It's the government's position that at that point...
When was his EAS, please?
The government is not aware of that fact at this time, Your Honor. 1 year later, on February 1st of the following year, his discharge was automatically remitted. However, again, under the government's position, that was not the trigger that authorized the return of his forfeitures.
Okay, so at the point in time that it was remitted, no forfeiture, he doesn't get his forfeitures.
That's
back.
Correct, Your Honor. Under the government's position, that was not a trigger because, again, our position is it goes against the meaning of the statute. As approved, does not provide for, most logically deals with cases where only part of the sentence is approved upon appellate review. In fact, this court very briefly in the Emanizer case discussed that. For example...
But why don't you can you finish the timeline, which is...
Oh, yes, Your Honor, I apologize. Only upon the decision by the lower court in 2004, July 30, 2004, when they disapproved the bad conduct discharge, that, according to the government's position, was the trigger that allowed this appellant for the return of his automatic forfeitures, not the February 1st of 2002 date when it was automatically remitted.
Can the CCA approve a discharge that's been remitted? Is that something within their authority?
They can approve a discharge and remit it to discharge at the same time.
Well, they're dealing with the discharge that's been remitted. That's the package that they have in front of them. Can they then approve the bad conduct discharge and ignore the remission?
At that point, they cannot, Your Honor. They can be done simultaneously. For example, countless convening authority actions have approved and then in the same action remitted discharges, which lends credence to the argument that they are different entities. They're not tantamount to each other. However, if a discharge is remitted, it cannot subsequently be executed or approved. It's a government's contention.
So when this package, this discharge came to the CCA, they could not approve it.
Under the Dietert and Olinger line of cases,
I thought you just said that if it's been remitted, then it can't be approved. And when it came to the CCA, it had been remitted. So if they couldn't approve it, why then is the disapproval different than the action they would have had to give in anyway?
Your Honor, government does agree that once something has been remitted, it cannot be later on approved. However, if you look at the language, again, specifically the language of forfeitures, it specifically states that there are very limited triggers on what constitutes the return of these forfeitures. For example, had the drafters wanted to use, to encompass remission, they could have done so very specifically. They could have added remission in the language of the statute, or they could have added in Article 58, Bravo Charlie, if the sentence as approved or executed does not include a bad conduct discharge, that would have clearly encompassed remission. Again, while when a remission cancels a discharge, according to many cases that have been cited in these briefs, it has to be taken in the context of those cases. It cancels the discharge in the sense that you can no longer approve it later on or carry it out on the appellant. When a discharge is canceled, it means basically an accused or an appellant is not going to get that discharge certificate. However, if you look at the language of the forfeiture statute, it specifically deals with approval. If you take cancel in its literal meaning, then as in, you know, to reduce to nothingness under the dictionary definition, if you take it literally cancel, then you would not have discharge to review at the lower court. The word cancel has to be taken in context in the limited sense of each particular case. The appellant is due the amount of $2,024.20. The amount he became entitled to with MCCA disapproved of bad conduct discharge, and this constitutes meaningful relief. Any additional relief provided by this court is not required by law and would result in a windfall for an undeserving appellant. And if there are no further questions, the government respectfully requests that this court affirm the findings and sentence as assigned below. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have any rebuttal?
Briefly touch on one of the government's concessions. It's argued that if a BCE has been remitted, if the package that arrives at the Court of Criminal Appeals involves a remitted bad conduct discharge, then the Court of Criminal Appeals cannot approve it. I believe that was what the government indicated in its argument. If that is the case, then there's no possible way under Article 58 BC or under Article 66 that the lower court could have done anything other than set aside, disapprove, or as finally approved, not approve the trigger of punishment.
Well, what do you think the meaningful relief that you could get here is? I mean, that's a question in my mind, which is there's no BCD left, right?
Yes, sir.
Your client is not in jail, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And as far as I read the statute, all that is available is for him to get the forfeitures back. And I don't think the government's disagreeing with that.
No, you're right, Your Honor.
So what additional relief, if any, are you requesting?
Setting aside his confinement and the reduction in the rank, we did have him to some extra monetary relief, as indicated in the appellant's brief under options 1 and 2. There would be some additional relief there. But more importantly, the appellant contends that that relief is case is really de minimis and inadequate given the post-trial delay in this case. Setting aside his findings, ultimately, 7-10 findings to prejudice would entitle Appellant to the ultimate relief, which is to eliminate this court martial from his plea record and also entitle him to the additional monetary relief on top of the return of his automatic forfeitures. That is the extra pay that he would be entitled to, particularly the return of the one-third pay at either the pay grade of E2 or E3 between April 7, 2000 and June 16, 2000. And additionally, the return of pay as full pay grade of E2 or E3 from June 16, 2000 until his pay officially stopped on November 7, 2000. Accordingly, appellant requests that this court provide relief outlined in the appellant's brief by either affording him, disapproving his confinement, and modifying his reduction in rank out to E2 or limiting it altogether, or perhaps more adequately, to set aside the findings of the sentence, thus entitled upon to return of not only his automatic forfeitures, which became due to him on February 1st, 2002, upon the initial bad conduct discharge, but also the additional pay which was taken from him by nature of his reduction in rank and his conviction, which is entirely unjust given the post-trial delay. There are no further questions.
Thank you, counsel. And we thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. This is the last scheduled argument for the term, so the court would take this opportunity to thank all counsel who have appeared before this court this term for your contributions to the military justice system and for your service on behalf of the men and women of the armed forces. And with that, we will stand in recess pending call of the court.
Court stands.